Hello and welcome to the Advent IM podcast. With me today I've got James Morris, MP, and Phil Ingram, MBE. Today we're going to be looking at education and in particular thinking about how we educate the security teams of the future in order to ensure that we remain as a profession fit for purpose and fit to face the challenges of the future. An area that's been talked about a lot over the last couple of years is the skills gap and the lack of young people who are entering into security as a profession, and in particular cybersecurity seems to be lacking, and also the fact that we continue to be largely a male-dominated profession with only about 8% of the profession being female. Maybe James, if we could start off by, you know, maybe talking a little bit about the work you've been doing in this area recently. And
sure. I mean, I think the issue about cyber skills is one that's been around for quite a long time. And I think there's a question which I'm not sure we've satisfactorily answered, which is what sort of skills do we actually need for the future? So there's a kind of a default position, which is that cyber skills is all about technical skill. Now, obviously, on one level, it is about technical skill, but it's also the case that it's also not just technical skills that we're talking about. You know, that some of the threats of the future and the way that we analyse them is also to do with behaviour, and it's to do with cultural issues within organisations. And so I think posing that question, what skills do we actually need for the future, is a fundamental one. And I think we should be looking a lot more at multidisciplinary education around cyber. So that will also enable us to address this issue, which is how do we encourage young people, graduates, non-graduates, whatever pathway that you're talking about, to actually want to go into a profession which is about cyber, and what routes they may end up going down. So I think if the answer to the question about skills is that we need much more focus on multidisciplinary education, then that feeds into how we structure both introductions to cyber at secondary level and how we would structure such courses in higher education, so that we begin to produce those multidisciplinary teams which can both address the technical challenges that we face, but also the broader challenges about understanding behaviour and culture, which is absolutely central to this. So I think one of the things that's characterised the debate about cyber skills is, say, the default thing is we have a gap because we're not training up enough technical people, but I think the gap is actually potentially more broad than that. We might not be asking the right question. So I throw that in as a starter for 10 in terms of just thinking about the question at hand.
Yeah. I think that's quite interesting, actually, because particularly in secondary school, cyber is taught as part of the IT curriculum rather than a topic in its own right. So, you know,
but I see it as a wider cultural issue. You know, if you look at, and I'm holding up my iPhone, you know, how many kids do you see going off to primary school at the moment with a smartphone? You know, that is connected to the world. And the one thing that goes wrong from a cyber perspective, the digital issue that's there, and again, for the listeners, I'm holding up my index finger, is that digit that clicks on something. So cyber starts in the physical world. It the pathway is the electronic pathway, and it ends up in an effect back in the physical world again. And the trouble is, as we start to talk cyber and cyber training and all the rest of it, a lot of people see it as an IT, as a technical issue, rather than just a cultural issue. And I think alongside getting, as James said, the right level of education, it's where do we start at? Do we start at a primary school and start to bring it in? Should it be something that's we try and culturally bring into parenting and everything else as something that is, you know, because IT underpins society. You know, we can't operate without all of our electronics anymore. So society should have that level that's there and bring the awareness in. And if we start to then break out the fact that it is a technical skill. It's something that is only for those who've got those specialist abilities to work in that environment. Then it'll become more of a norm. It'll become easier, I think, to get people recruited into it. It'll become easier to bring in those with the right sort of skill sets in the different parts of it. You want the technical geeks to do the technical mathematical bit, the coding bit when they're in there, but you want other people who can go out and advise and make sure and do the human bits and make sure the right interactions and the right cultural pieces are there. They might not necessarily be the technical experts.
Mm-hmm. Have we maybe missed a trick there then in the schools, because the government's cyber schools program and the launch of Cyber Discovery mm-hmm. has very much been embedded into those schools that are running this program as an IT focused
yeah.
topic. Mm-hmm. So,
well, exactly. I mean, I think we probably need to look at the structuring of that. So, there does need to be an enhanced focus on STEM subjects at schools. That we do need to be embedding technical education at an early age. So I can understand the thrust of that, but I think that we do need to be broadening it out, because the cyber security, cyber challenges of the future are going to require a very highly flexible mindset, and all kids coming out of education are going to need to some degree to be literate in computing and literate in languages and so on. But it's also the case that they need to develop a more intuitive understanding. So I think you're right that we do need to think about that curriculum, think about what government initiatives are attempting to achieve, if I'm right that we're not asking precisely the right question right now about cyber skills. Mm-hmm. So the paradigm is cyber skills is all about, we've got this gap and it's a technical education gap. If we take loads of initiative to improve technical education, we'll solve the problem. Mm. Now, some of that is necessary, but I don't think it necessarily addresses all of the wider strategic issues that we face. Mm. So, and I know the government is currently looking at developing the cyber skills strategy. It's due to come out, I think it was due to come out before the end of the year, but whether that will happen, I'm not sure. But I do know that there's been a lot of quite fertile discussions about precisely this issue of how we're defining the problem. Because it's one of those things, in public policy, as you know, very often there's a whole bunch of subjects where the discussion rotates around the same areas. Every year, every 5 years, we talk about the fact that we've got a cybersecurity skill shortage, but we never actually get to the point where we say, oh, actually, we're solving it. Mm. And this public policy area in particular has got a lot of those characteristics. Mm. So in some ways, we must be doing something wrong because we're taking loads of initiatives and we've still got the problem.
And actually, we've been talking about the lack of girls going into STEM subjects for a long time.
Yeah.
And this is an extension of that. Whether that's because predominantly IT in secondary schools is taught by men and is seen as something, computing is seen as attractive to the lads, not to the girls. I think it's something we do need to grasp, because we're missing out on a whole demographic of our population that's not coming into this profession at the moment.
Yeah.
I hear what you're saying and I agree completely with that, but I think what we mustn't get into the position of doing is turning around and saying we have to have positive discrimination for one sex or one background or whatever else artificially. It's setting the bar in such a way that there's no bar to entry. It's open for everyone, and educating everyone that there's that common understanding. I've got a military background. Everyone would think the military is a big macho organisation, and we've just seen the piece where all roles in the military have been opened up to both sexes. Well, I was military intelligence. Some of my best soldiers, some of my best officers were my female soldiers and officers. And when they were in uniform as part of my battalion, you didn't know what sex they were. You didn't care what sex they were. They did fantastic jobs. Mm-hmm. And I had women who went out and served on the front line with special forces. That was a cultural thing that we brought in over a period of time. If we can do that in the military, why can't society be doing that? What is it, and I think there's the bigger thing we have to ask is, what is it in society that is causing that feeling that there is, you know, one path for girls, one path for boys. And if we can address that bigger issue, then I think the rest of it will fix itself.
But I think also, I think the diversity question is actually slightly more complex than just the gender, the gender thing, although that is important. It's, you know, in my experience, you know, before I got involved in politics, I was in the software business myself for almost 20 years and set up software development teams, which can, you know, in a Victorian warehouse in East London. And one of the things that really struck me about that is often in organisations, small organisations, the most innovative thinking comes out of informal networks and informal discussion. That's particularly important in relation to cyber, because I think one of the big issues of discussion at the moment is the skills on the technical side which are required to combat a lot of the emerging threats we have are those which are learnt by people playing around with systems and learning how people are attacking and defending and whatever. And those people are often not the sort of people who can who either want to or can fit into a conventional career path. And therefore, we need to think about how we can harness that diversity. So how do we encourage people who are looking at the world from a completely different perspective, often in informal ways outside of the normal 9-to-5 conventional workspace, to be able to develop a career, to come up with ideas, and not those ideas not getting snuffed out in the normal kind of conventional bureaucratic processes of organisations. Mm. Now, that I think that's also about diversity, because that's all about how we encourage innovation and how we encourage challenge. But somebody who's got that, I mean, some of the best software developers I've ever worked with in my life are people who come up with their best ideas sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning, exactly. And not at sort of 11 o'clock in the morning, in a team meeting about innovation.
Yeah.
And that is particularly important in relation to this cyber area. And also the role that women can bring to those project teams as well is something which I think has not been explored sufficiently. Because sometimes, again, it's not just about the technical skill, it's about how they get translated into something that works. And in my experience, when I've been working with software development teams which have a mixed gender and a mixed group, you tend to get better solutions because you've got a variety of different perspectives. And again, I think that's an important sort of consideration.
Yeah, you don't get constrained by groupthink if you have diversity.
Exactly. Yes.
How many times in business, whenever you've approached a team problem, have you said, right team, I want you to think outside the box and come up with solutions? Well, if you've got people or you've got a team that hasn't got diversity built into that team, whether that be between the sexes, whether that be between people who are classed as neurodiverse, and we have to recognise that there are strengths and weaknesses in having that label applied to certain people. But if you don't have those skill sets inherent in your team, how can you think outside the box? Because you're all going to be thinking the same, you're all going to get the group think, and you're not going to be able to come up with those innovative solutions. So I think it's important that business leaders recognise that there are real benefits from having diversity, whether it be cultural, whether it be sexual, whether it be people coming in with labelled conditions that allow them to look at the solutions from as many different angles as they can. Now, that's a management challenge and a leadership challenge, but that should be something that should be embraced. And it's getting that culture into business as well, that having people who are thinking differently is not a risk. It's an advantage. And again, I'll come back to another military example. I had a sergeant major who I told him to go from A to B to achieve a task. And I'd be watching him and expect him to go from A along the straight path to B. And all of a sudden, he'd disappear behind me. And he'd appear at B before I'd even recognised what would have everything done and would have even more done and more achieved. He always thought completely outside the box, got done what needed to be done, and did things that I even didn't think needed to be done, because he just approached things from a different perspective. And his, as a very junior soldier, he changed his name to, by deed poll, to the Reverend Mortimer Mortimer. I love my Kawasaki 650, ahumna, ahumna. I'll not tell you what his surname is, but that shows how diverse he was in his thinking. And if we can embrace that sort of thing in a rigid cultural environment such as the military, and recognise the strengths mm-hmm. it brings. Industry and education and everyone out in civilian street should be able to do that quite easily.
Absolutely. So I guess as well as, you know, looking at what we need to do at the school's end of things, we need to be engaging with business leadership and helping them to understand the strengths of diversity and helping them to see where, you know, these different groups can bring benefits and indeed profitability to business.
Yeah. And I think it's all in the language. It's, you know, everyone at the moment thinks if you're bringing someone who's diverse, it's the same with disabilities and all the rest of it. Oh, there's a risk. You know, we might not pass the required standards. We might not have the ramps. We might not have this. Instead of approaching things from a risk perspective, approach from a benefits perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's educating business, educating society that diversity brings benefits. It doesn't bring risks.
How do we turn security from what is largely still a hobbyist practitioner, you know, with people like myself rapidly, you know, going into their 50s as the first generation of real security pros? And how do we go from that situation to a situation where it is a proper profession with a proper core body of knowledge and something that is exciting to the next generation of bright sparks?
Well, I think you're right that one of the challenges that we have is about trying to improve the image of the profession, if we're talking more practically. So it's looking at the nature of professional qualifications. I think some of the proposals that are being mooted for the future cyber skills strategy is around a national cybersecurity council. So you start to get more coherence around what is the challenges we face and what are the kind of the knowledge base that we need, and so that you've got clear pathways. So that's where I think there is a critical question about what role the government can play, because I think in the early iterations of the cybersecurity strategy, there was the idea that the private sector would, as it were, kind of pick up the slack. And I think one of the challenges is that the private sector has picked up the slack to a certain degree, but I think the government has got probably more of a role in shaping that market to some extent. So that's why, and to bring coherence to the challenge, because again, you know, there is quite a fragmented series of challenges out there and some fragmented initiatives. And so maybe, you know, as part of the future cyber skills strategy, we do need to see government playing a role, perhaps in the creation of this new cybersecurity council, which acts as a way of bringing coherence to the market, and government can play a role in that. So I think that's probably one of the challenges that we face.
And you've hit on one of my pet subjects, as you know. When we talk about the wider cybersecurity strategy, I think we get our approach to security slightly wrong, because there isn't an overarching professional body. There's some very good initiatives out there that are addressing things that are coming up, and we saw that yesterday at the International Security Expo, where the Security Institute brought 50 or so police cadets around 13 to 17 year old to introduce them to the wide variety of careers and things that there are within the wider security environment. Because a lot of people, you say security, people think of the doorman or the guard in the shop, or they think of the geek that's sitting there on the cyber side. The initiatives that are coming up from the membership organisations are absolutely fantastic. But they're membership organisations, and they have to look after the interests of their members. They're not in a position, no matter how they try, to lift themselves up and become that overarching professional body that sets the standards, that monitors what people are getting up to and says, these are the qualifications you have to be able to fulfil that role, that works in with government to get that advice in there. And I think we're almost at the stage now, because there is such diversity in the wider security piece, that we need that professional body in there to give that oversight. And we should try and break, you know, cyber is one component of security. And we need to recognise that the overarching banner should be security, and then we look at cyber, and then we look at physical, and then we look at convergence between the two, which are the big cries.
So do we need to be bold and visionary here and be looking at not developing a cyber education strategy, but actually a total security education strategy, much as you would see in, for example, most other professions, you know, accountancy, medicine, architecture, engineering, where you would study all of those diverse areas of security and then find your pathway to a specialism, rather than starting as a specialism and then being expected to know more as you get more senior.
I think there's a lot in that, and as I say, I think we need to challenge some of our received assumptions about the curriculum and our approach, particularly maybe in higher education settings. So I think there's quite a lot in what you say in terms of trying to address this issue.
And I think the problem that there is in getting security into business and everything else is, with security, the measurement of success for the business leaders is nothing happens. So trying to convince people that they need to spend budget on security and security education, security culture and all the rest of it is really, really difficult when nothing happens and people are against profit margins. And it's getting that understanding of those that are the business leaders of what security does. And I'd almost go further and argue that the chief security officer in any large organization should be a businessman first and foremost, and has the security specialist advising him or her, not a security specialist who's just got to the top of their tree, unless they've gone and got the business training and the wider perspective that's there.
No, I think that's an equally important point, because again, we've been talking about skills required to achieve certain things, but also I think there's a question about leadership education as well in all of this, because in the end, this is not a challenge which could somehow be separated off from other business challenges. It's about chief executives and the boards of companies taking responsibility for actually dealing with something which could provide a major strategic threat to their business, without thinking that somehow that can be either the kind of departmentalized, if you like. So the nature of leadership in a world which is facing these type of threats, constantly evolving challenges, is also, I think, something that maybe needs to be thought of in terms of MBA education and so on.
Right. So just picking up on what you were saying there, Phil, about, security is successful when nothing happens. Mm-hmm. Is there a lesson to be learned from the journey that professions like health and safety have been on? Because actually, with health and safety, when nothing happens, that is seen as a benefit. And you go to a construction site and they'll have billboards everywhere telling you how many days it is since they've had an accident. And maybe actually what we need, instead of having all the various, CTOs and CSOs and everything else all jockeying for position on the board, is actually that pinnacle at the board should actually be a chief risk officer.
I couldn't agree more. The difference between health and safety and security is health and safety has got a primary legislation underneath it. And if health and safety legislation is broken, members of the board are going to jail if something happens. Security, there isn't. So, and I'll caveat that slightly with under General Data Protection Regulation that's come in now, the legal aspect of that and data protection, members of a board of a company are now personally responsible for a lot of the outcomes that can come and can be held personally responsible in court. A lot of board members don't realise that at the moment. So it's coming in. So the boards need to start to bring that health and safety type culture into their approach to security. And once that comes in, and unfortunately I think it's going to take a big stick on a couple of occasions for people to suddenly go, oh, crikey, I need to do something about this. And once that comes in, then I think it'll start to solve itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, the nature of risk that needs to be assessed at boardroom level is now much more sophisticated than it's ever been. Business risk 20 years ago would have been about looking at certain aspects of the external environment and what's the risk to the business of X happening. Now, risk is something actually that probably needs to be assessed on daily, half daily, sometimes hourly basis in terms of the potential threat and risk to the business. So it becomes a much more live issue which requires much more senior management engagement.
And it needs to become a much more agile part of business as usual as well, doesn't
Absolutely.
It? Rather than something that's seen as, an annual review process. It's got to be something that we're doing all the time. Yeah. And again, I guess, bringing in those people from different backgrounds, different diversities, different cultural backgrounds, is going to help us to break that, what I think we do have at the moment, which is group thinking around, we've always done it this way.
Yep.
So that's the way security is getting done.
Very, very much so. We have to bring it in as a cultural part of just our normal way of life, the normal way we do business. It shouldn't be seen as anything scary. You know, all our risks should be put together and run from a one single risk matrix, whether it's your health and safety risk or your security risk or something else. And then, depending on the level it's at, someone is given ownership of that risk. And where you're looking at things that are related to threats, you then base that on wider intelligence, whether it be business intelligence, so you've got business risk looked at as to what's happening in your investments in the market, or whether it be security intelligence, because the terrorist threat level has just gone up and you need to make sure that the physical barriers you have in your building to stop people coming in are there. It's the same, it's just a risk.
I would add that the challenge there is also, if you think about the challenge about national critical infrastructure. We're talking here about private business, but there was a recent report from the Select Committee, from the committee which scrutinises the National Security Council, mm-hmm. and they were making some comments about, again, if you think about public sector, or you think about the protection of critical national infrastructure, we've got challenges in that area, again, around assessment of risk, regulation, responsiveness within government, who's taking responsibility for what. So it's a challenge which is not only there for private sector businesses, it's there for national governments and for, you know, aspects of our critical national infrastructure which have a risk, particular risk profile.
And in fact, one of the criticisms in that report was that Parliament wasn't doing enough and didn't appear to be taking, despite categorising cyber as a tier one threat,
yeah.
didn't actually seem to be prepared to fully grasp it and lead on the area of cyber.
Yeah, well, I think I'm just about to become chair of the all-party parliamentary group for cybersecurity. And part of the function of that cross-party group is to raise awareness about cybersecurity across Parliament. And I think Parliament can play a role. That committee is a cross-party parliamentary committee, which is its job is to scrutinise the NSC. And I think, as you're right, the broader point that was being made in that report was about partly about the machinery of government and how government mm-hmm. deals with the problem of critical national infrastructure. And I think Parliament's probably got a greater role to play in raising awareness about some of those issues and asking the right questions of the government. When issues arise and trying to engage in a productive cross-party debate.
Mm. I think some of the reports that have come out at the moment have been sort of unfairly critical because actually, is it the responsibility of government, MPs, ministers and all the rest of it to actually do this? Or is it their responsibility to put the mechanisms in place to do it? And like anything, anything in government working at that level is like a super tanker and you're trying to change course, it takes time. One of the best initiatives that come in recent times and is the envy of the world is the creation of the National Cybersecurity Centre. Mm. And what they're doing out to help business, what they're doing out to help critical national infrastructure, what they're doing to help demystify a lot of what's behind it, the intelligence behind it, and give access into GCHQ capability is phenomenal. Yeah. And therefore, did we see that being praised?
No, I think that's a fair point. I mean, the creation of the National Cybersecurity Centre is I think is sort of global best in class response.
Yeah.
I think some of the comments in the report were more about machinery of government who coordinates. I think you made a recommendation about having a minister specifically responsible for cybersecurity, which I think there's some potential being with the Cabinet Office playing a kind of coordinating role across government. I think one of the challenges which they identified in there was also about National Cybersecurity Centre doing an excellent job, but demand, again, outstripping supply in terms of their ability to actually perform the function. So it's, I think you're right. I mean, that has been a great success story and is a global best in class.
I think that's very interesting, James, because given that we have been talking a lot as well about the current skills gap, the skills deficit, and some of the reports are estimating that we've got a generational gap in skills coming through. That is surely also going to impact on the ability of organisations like the National Cybersecurity Centre to continue to be world class.
Mm. Well, yeah, no, so that I mean, that was one of the things which was brought up in the report we were just describing. And again, it speaks to the challenges that we've been talking about here, which is creating that funnel of talent. The challenges when we were discussing the issue of diversity, how do you get somebody who has a hacking mentality, if that's the right way of describing it, wanting to work on behalf of the government? That's one of the challenges. So how do you harness that energy and the capacity for innovation for somebody who wants to end up working for the National Cybersecurity Council? And also, again, it's about the type of skills which that organisation needs in the future to be able to successfully work with private business, work with those people responsible for running critical national infrastructure, which is, again, skills which are about leadership, about challenge, about how to consult and to work with other organisations successfully.
And, of course, the more of those technically adept children that we convince to come into a professional role, the less there are to be ending up in a criminal role. And so actually it's a win-win situation because we end up with less hackers.
Well, I think that's a very good way of looking at it, yeah.
Mm. But I think there's another area where government can help here, and that's looking at getting responsible manufacturing into our electronic devices and everything else. If we look at the Internet of Things, the devices that are coming out at the moment, there's no security built into those. There's no single standard that there is across there. Yeah. We look at the speed of innovation and how fast technology is developing. There's no way is any government structure going to be able to keep up with that. So I think we have to get government and industry working together to try and bring this culture of security in. And then we get into artificial intelligence, and we haven't even touched on that. Yeah. I had a debate about 18 months ago where we were talking about Internet of Things, and I was talking to Eugene Kaspersky from Kaspersky Labs, and he said, it's not the Internet of Things, it's the Internet of Threats. And I then expanded into AI and said, if we can't keep our networks secure today, and the US Department of Defense had just had their personnel database hacked, and all those that held top secret security clearances had leaked. If you can't even keep that sort of thing secure, when we get into artificial intelligence and we get computers starting to think and become more powerful and get into that thinking level of the human brain, I go back to 2001: A Space Odyssey. And when I asked a senior academic about that, he said, "Oh, don't worry, we'll secure our AI systems in the future in the same way we secure our systems today." And I went,
"Yeah, I mean, we're getting into a little bit of abstract territory here, but I think, for example, I've been talking to a few people at the Warwick Manufacturing Group at Warwick University, where they've been working with R&D, people working in R&D, to sort of like the ethics of R&D. So when thinking about big developments for the future, how can we build in the idea of AI applications, if it's the right way of describing it, behaving ethically? I know that's a massive philosophical debate, which we probably can't get into on this podcast. But again, that speaks to, in a way, it is linked to what we've been talking about, because it's about what that means in terms of skill import and the relationship between humans and robotics. But that might be for another day, possibly.
I would think so. But the other one for another day is you're looking at then how that increases the threat base that's out there. And we've seen recently the Russians hacking into different systems, and it's quite clear that they've been doing that. We've got state. And it's not state on state anymore, it's state on enterprise. But we're also getting state on SME, because that's in the supply chain to get into something that they're interested in, whether that be to steal intellectual property, or whether it be to do something to embarrass a political structure, or to do something else. So this subject is huge, and people need to recognise the size of it, and then look at what directly affects you and get it into those boundaries and deal with it as the wider risk bit and put it in there. But recognize that the more you think into it, the more you think the future, the more you actually have to bring it into your business planning or your governmental planning or your education planning, because it's not going to go away.
So I mentioned earlier the cyber discovery and the government's cyber school program, and a number of the academies that have introduced that have said, whilst it has not necessarily at this stage resulted in more people taking security as a career, what it has definitely done has raised the profile and the awareness within those children's groups of how they need to be behaving and how they need to be looking after themselves online. So there's a real benefit to society, if not necessarily to the profession at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there is the on effect of societal benefit, and we need to, you know, this is about driving it into the sort of web and wharf of social life, isn't it? Because again, you know, in the future, as we have more online applications that you were talking about, more Internet of Things, the more everything becomes connected, and then it becomes just part of the kind of living tissue of being a human being in society. And that is one of the potential ways in which we flip this paradigm from just talking about security to being a broader societal issue about how we deal with this. And education has to play a role in that. So that's why, as part of it, it's not just technical, it's ethical, it's about the whole debate between privacy and identity in our society. So, you know, it's got some broader implications too about how we speak about this subject.
And it's the old adage, security is everyone's responsibility. You know, it's not the responsibility of the security team or the security guards or the security investigators. They're there to make sure that the processes and bits and pieces are in place and to try and fix something if it goes wrong. But if you've got a culture in wherever you are of everyone understanding security and understanding their part of it, in the same way that we're asking society, you're the best police eyes and ears in society to deal with terrorism are the people who are going about their day-to-day jobs. It's not just having lots and lots more police or lots more security services around, because no matter how many you get there, you can't have them everywhere. But everyone's everywhere, and if you spot something that's wrong and you've got the mechanisms and you understand you're part of the wider culture to report it to the right level, and the mechanisms are then in place to investigate and deal with it, then that's the important piece.
The next step then, James, and you say you're going to be chair of the committee. Where do you see us over the next sort of 12 to 18 months being able to take this whole matter?
Well, I think part of the role, I think, of the cross-party group and with this new cyber skills strategy being put out, I think we need to engage in this broader debate to shape future thinking. I think it's important that's done on a cross-party basis in Parliament, and as we've been discussing, to raise the issue of cyber, because at the moment it's sort of still in the area of being a kind of niche interest, if that's, but you know, from what we've been discussing today, we all know it's not a niche interest, it's something that's all pervasive and prevalent. But part of the role of all party groups in Parliament and the sort of discussions we're having today is to, you know, make it, to put context around the current challenges that we face, so that parliamentarians who are in an influential position in their constituencies and in Parliament can begin to have a bit more of an informed debate about the challenges, so that the right questions can be asked of government ministers and so on.
And this is, I would say this is too important for it to ever be political, which is why it's so important that it is cross-party and it is collaborative, and that we're driving change in our thinking and in our approach to security, so that we can become better able to protect society, businesses, and ultimately government from the ever-evolving threat.
Absolutely. I think it does transcend party politics in that sense. There's a lot of, you know, members of Parliament and peers actually from all political parties who are very sighted on this issue, and that's what we need to build on.
Well, cross-party groups are the perfect example of diversity. You've got political diversity built into there. It's just ensuring that there's sufficient politicians on the groups to bring in the wider diversity bit. But and that's where the real business of the country and running the country is done properly and done well. It's whenever we start to polarize people and put them into different camps, and you've got the reds versus the blues, or one versus the other, because there's a difference, that we get this adversarial approach, and that's when we don't get anything done.
Well, I think we've had a really fascinating discussion there around the future of security, the cybersecurity arena, the education and the need for change, and perhaps the need to divorce cyber from IT and from IT thinking. Most importantly, the need to embrace diversity of all sorts of backgrounds, education, business needs, government, and to truly make sure that what we do for the future, for us, for the next generation of security professionals, for society, for businesses, and for UK PLC, is to make us fit for purpose to truly defend our assets against that emerging threat. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great to have you here. And who knows, maybe we will have a follow-up session talking about artificial intelligence and ethics and morality and, what really does happen when machines start to think for themselves. Thank you very much. Mike.